are listening to Radio Albion. Hello there, guys. At the risk of sounding like every other YouTuber out there, I'd really, really appreciate it if you'd click the subscribe button. It's free, it doesn't cost you anything, and it allows my channel to grow, which means guests like the one you're about to watch, as well as more, would be willing to come on. Just give it a like, give it a subscribe, and we'll go from there. All right, thank you, and enjoy this episode. So today on Laments, I've got Mr. Mark Collett. Mark, how are you doing?
Hello, my friend. It's good to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm looking forward to having a decent chat with you.
No, thank you. Now, for those that don't know who you are, if they were to Google you, you get some quite derogatory terms come up. People call you, I saw Hitler simp when I was doing my research. I think simping is something to do with OnlyFans girls. I don't know. I'm a bit old for all that shit. The neo-Nazi, Nazi. How would you describe yourself?
Well, I describe myself as an ethno-nationalist. I've always described myself as a nationalist, but now there seems to be sort of two camps. You have the sort of civic nationalists and you have the ethno-nationalists. I'm an ethno-nationalist. I am English. I'm proud to be English. And I believe that white Britons, i.e. the English, the Scottish and the Welsh, they deserve a homeland just like any other ethnic group. And my belief is basically that we as a people need to turn around the demographic changes taking place, because I don't want white Britons to become a minority. And secondly, I want to ensure that Britain is run by the indigenous people for the benefit of the indigenous people. So I want us to remain a supermajority in our homeland. And I also want our homeland to be run for our benefit rather than for the benefit of people who are foreign or for the benefit of foreign countries.
You know what? I'm not going to lie. That sounds like it's right out of the playbook of Restore Britain. Do you know Rupert Lowe?
Well, I mean, Rupert Lowe is now talking my talking points, because I've been doing this since 2000. I'm now 45. I've been doing this for 26 years. I first got involved in this when I was at university. And it's very interesting to see that the things that I was deplatformed from X for, the things that I've had my bank accounts taken away for, the reasons I've been banned from any form of foreign travel are essentially now the policy points of people like Rupert Lowe. So the things that I've faced such repression for over my lifetime are now the talking points of a sitting MP. And it tells you that there is a massive vibe shift at the moment. What we're seeing is this unprecedented political change where people are talking about things that at one point were seen as highly taboo. And it was quite a taboo thing. And as I said, I have suffered sort of quite heavily because of my political beliefs. I've been doing this. I've been consistent in doing this for the past 26 years. But now these things are breaking into the mainstream. They are being spoken about in Parliament. And obviously, Rupert Lowe's now got 100,000 members who obviously agree with these talking points, which is incredible because obviously I was in the British National Party at the height. It had 14,500 members. We got two MEPs elected to Brussels, but it was nowhere near on the size and scale of what Rupert Lowe's doing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean Rupert Lowe's going to win a general election, but what it does mean is that there has been a huge change in the way people think and people's willingness to talk about race, ethnicity and demography.
It's interesting you mentioned that. Actually, I had one of your compatriots or previous compatriots, Nick Griffin, on a few months ago, and it gives you the vibe shift as you mention it. I think that scored 10,000 views at my last check. And I had lots of people saying, you know, you can't speak to Nick Griffin. I got a lot of abuse for it as well. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to talk to the chap and get his side of things, which is why we're having this conversation as well. I don't go by what other people tell me, as you've probably seen, Mark. You've seen my channel. I go by going to the source, go to the horse's mouth sort of situation. So, yeah, you were part of the BNP, which is why I think you get slated as much as you do. Obviously, as we've just said, these conversations around race and ethnicity are now breaking through. You've got Rupert Lowe not sort of spearheading that, but he's definitely picked up the baton and is running with it. His party is doing very well. It's interesting, really. He talks about remigration a lot. He talks about millions must go. I know you know Steve Laws, and he's a big fan of, or big promoter of, remigration. What's your view of that? Do you think that we should get rid of everyone that isn't English?
Well, I do believe that millions should go, but I have, or both myself and the people I work with have always said we would like Britain to be around 95% white British. And if you stated that as a point, I think that's something that most people who are reasonable could agree with. We're not saying that every single person who's got a tiny drop of foreign blood must go, but lots of them do have to go, and we have to bring about a situation where the indigenous people of these islands are a super majority and a stable super majority. So we don't want to say 95%, then in 5 years it's 90%, you know, then in another 5 years it's 85%. We don't want to go back down that road. So it would have to be a figure where the indigenous people were an overwhelming majority and that majority was maintained. Now, when we're starting to talk about people being sort of sent home or expelled or remigrated or repatriated, as we used to call it in the BNP, you know, we've got to talk about this sensibly. There are 21 million people here in Britain today who are not white British, who are not indigenous or have some kind of mixed race heritage. Now, if we were going down the route of mass remigration or repatriation, as we used to call it, there is a sensible way of approaching this. And we're not talking about putting 21 million people on boats in a single year and getting rid of them. There would be a system of doing this which would be sensible. It would be, it would obviously take people's needs into account. So the first people you would send back would be illegal migrants, because really there are three types of people in this country who are not indigenous. There are people who shouldn't be here because they're illegal migrants. So you've got the illegal migrants, you've got visa overstayers, you've got people who have no legal right to be here. Then you've got people who've got a legal right to be here but are not British citizens. They are people who are citizens of other countries that have gained residency here, work permits, visas, they might be studying. They're here, but they're not actually British citizens. Then finally, you have the third group, which are people who are here and are not indigenous to these islands, and they have British citizenship. Now, they're not indigenous, but they have a passport. They have attained citizenship.
Right.
Now, obviously, if you were to bring in, like, look, if somebody gave you sort of like Marvel superhero powers and you were sort of Thanos and you could just snap your fingers and these people all disappeared, that would be all well and good. But that's not how it works in the real world. And there's a lot of people who say, like, oh, you know, they've all got to go, they've all got to go. But you have to put forward a policy that would actually work. And you have to realize that you couldn't do this overnight. It couldn't be done with the snap of your fingers. So you deal with the first group first. And the first group were illegal migrants. Now, day one, they would all have to go. You would have to start rounding them up and you would have to start deporting them. They are here illegally. They have no right whatsoever to be here. And they have come here. And by the mechanism of coming here, they have broken our laws. And we do not want criminal migrants here. I think that's a fair point. I don't
Are
think
we
that's
talking about the
outrageous.
ones coming across on the boats and things like that?
Anybody who is here that has broken the law to be here and has broken, whether you are a visa overstayer, whether you are somebody who has entered on a small boat, whether you are somebody that has stowed away in, you know, on a plane or, you know, in a lorry on the Channel Tunnel, makes no difference. If you are here illegally and you have broken our laws to enter this country, you go immediately. So you would deal with the first group with a stroke of a pen. Now, the second group are people who are here legally but do not have right to remain because they're not British citizens. So they do not have a passport. You would deal with them rather swiftly as well. You would wait until any work visas ran out. You would not reissue them. You would cl any of those people who are here and were not British citizens and that were out of work claiming benefit, they would have to go. You know, why on earth we have people here in Britain who are not British citizens, but they are claiming benefits, I don't know. I mean, I don't think you or I would be able to, you know, turn up in Japan or Nigeria or, you know, or India and immediately be able to just go to some government office and start getting free money. So you would then chip them out. Then you would look at people who were here through the visa scheme or here through some temporary measure who had broken the law. Now, anybody that comes into our house and violates our laws and breaks the laws, they will be leaving. And I think that's a sensible policy as well. And over time, you would drastically reduce the number of foreign nationals living in Britain, starting aggressively with lawbreakers and people who were claiming benefits. And eventually, over a period of time, people would run down their visas, those visas wouldn't be reissued, the foreign nationals would leave, and you would make sure there was no birthright citizenship. So even if they had children on British soil, that doesn't give you the right to remain. And I know that America has gone down that route recently. Donald Trump has attempting to abolish birthright citizenship because people have these what are known as anchor babies, which allow them to stay. And that would leave you with the third group. So the first two groups, the illegal immigrants and those here legally who are foreign nationals, you would deal with those two groups extremely quickly and those problems would be solved. And that would leave you with people living here who are not indigenous and who have British passports, essentially British citizens, but not natives. Now, they would be dealt with in a number of ways. We could offer them reasonable grants to leave. And at the same time, we could pass laws that essentially bring about something that the government keeps crowing about. The government always talks about equality, doesn't it? We always hear about the importance of equality. We've all got to be equal. We've all got to be treated equally under the law. Well, no one gives me £150 £150 an hour interpreter to go to the council office. So we'll treat everyone with a British passport equally. And if they don't speak English, they're not entitled to benefits. If their children don't speak English, they're not entitled to go into the educational system. They're not entitled to state education. If you don't speak English, you are not entitled to an interpreter in hospitals because all of these things are inequalities which put white Britons at a disadvantage. We pay for these things, but we don't get these benefits. And that overnight would begin to incentivize people with British passports to take the grants to leave. We would ban false face coverings in public. We would ban kosher and halal slaughter and the importation of meat that was slaughtered in a cruel manner. And overnight, you would see millions choosing to go home. And we would also look at people who had British citizenship, but also had citizenship of other nations. So if there was a Jamaican man, let's say, and he had both British and Jamaican citizenship, and he had raped someone, he would have his British citizenship stripped. And that would be completely legal under international law because any nation can strip a citizen of their citizenship if they have citizenship of another nation, where there is a grey zone under international law, not that I'm a big fan of international law, but this actually does abide by it, is if you strip somebody of citizenship and they don't have citizenship of another nation. So you couldn't strip somebody of British citizenship if they didn't have a dual citizenship and couldn't go anywhere else. But there are many people living in Britain who have a British passport but are dual citizens. And dual citizens that have broken the law, committed benefit fraud, have never worked, don't speak English, they could have their citizenship stripped. And over time, what you would end up with, it might take 5 years, it might take a decade. I don't think it'd take much longer. but you would see a dramatic turnaround when it came to demographics. It would create a hostile environment for illegal migrants. It would more or less cut immigration to zero, and you would see a massive number of people leaving. And over 5 to 10 years, the demographic shifts would be drastically reversed, and you would also stop paying the people who are here and aren't indigenous to have children. So I'll give you a great example. Labour lifted the benefit, the two-child benefit cap. Well, which three ethnic groups in Britain have the largest family size on average? I can tell you straight off the top of my head and list them in order. Number one, Pakistanis. Number two, Bangladeshis. Number three, Indians. So people who come here from the Indian subcontinent have by far the highest birth rate and the largest family size. Labour are currently paying them to breed by lifting that benefit cap. By lifting that benefit cap, Labour are putting in place a form of indirect discrimination that pays certain migrant communities to have children. There would also be policy reversals like that, again, that would see thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions leave simply because that policy was reversed. And once you've done that, you would end up with a small number of people here, 5%, who were not white British. They would be fellow Europeans. They would be a limited number of people of mixed race origin who are half English and say half something else, because they can say, well, look, I do have partial English heritage or part Scottish heritage, whatever. But it would be a manageable number that was maintained and did not start to creep above that 5% threshold. And then it wouldn't be discriminating against people, like a man who, say, has a Polish wife or, somebody who was of mixed European origin, but their family had, lived here for sort of 50, 60 years, And I think that would be fair. I think most people would accept that. The idea of sending people home doesn't have to be one of people marching down the street in uniforms, pulling people out of their houses and loading them into sort of, lorries at the point of a bayonet. Sensible policy change would turn this around. And if you extend that, an extension of that is, once you understand that sensible policy change could turn this around, you understand that it is policy change, bad policy, that has brought us to this point, a mixture of horrendous government policy, which has created both push and pull factors, has incentivized millions of people from overseas to come to these islands because we treat them as first-class citizens and we treat the indigenous people at best as second class and at worst a hated minority that are preyed upon by the people who arrive here.
It does seem everything you've just said sounds like it could have come from Restore or Advance Britain. It really does. And like you say, it has crept into the discourse. Yet, what, 5, 10 years ago, you were vilified for these views. Now, you're no longer part of the BNP. I don't think Nick Griffin's part of it anymore. Do you know Simon Tomlin?
You might want to cut this bit out, but Simon
I
Tomlin
don't edit
is.
anything. I do not
Well,
edit
Simon
anything.
Tomlin's a strange guy that has all these fanciful stories of
Right.
what he's done and where he's been. He's written all these sort of strange books, some that claim he's an MI5 spy, some that claims he was on the run from MI5. He has these fanciful stories that he was this big player in the British National Party. He wasn't. In fact, he's kind of a strange guy. You can look up his criminal history. He
Right.
was arrested and actually jailed for stalking and harassment of a woman who was in the wider nationalist movement. This can all be found quite easily. He's not somebody that's a fan of me. He's really a Walter Mitty that makes a lot of things up.
The reason I ask is obviously he's got his own podcast. I'm not name dropping anything, but it's the Daily Agenda. Obviously, I've seen it. He has mentioned you. I just wanted to know your
He
side of
mentions
things from
everyone.
it.
He's one of these people who is endlessly embroiled in a series of beefs with different people. So He rages about me. He rages about Steve Laws. He rages about Tommy Robinson. He rages about Nigel Farage. He rages about Rupert Lowe. He rages about Nick Griffin. Now, I'm not saying all those people like one another, and some of those people don't. You know, I like Rupert Lowe. I like Steve Laws. I don't like Tommy Robinson, but he doesn't like anyone. And if you look into him, you'll find out that he is a Walter Mitty that lives in sort of this little pocket universe of his own creation. He's written a load of these really strange books. You know, some claim he, so one of his books claims he has magical powers or something like that. He, very strange guy. All of this is on the internet. You can Google it. You know, if you just put in sort of Simon Tomlin, Eastwood Advertiser, it comes up with his attempts to sort of get the Eastwood Advertiser to remove headlines about him, which relate to his stalking and harassment, which he was jailed for. You know, this guy is not, you know, a nice guy. He's not a good guy. He's a very strange guy that makes up that he's had this big sort of impactful career in nationalism. He hasn't. I never met him when I was in the BNP. He never did anything of note when I was in the BNP. He might have been a member briefly, and he's fallen out with everybody that you could imagine. So, yeah, he's not a big fan of me, but he's not a big fan of anyone.
No, that's fair enough. Now, moving on from the BNP, we talked about remigration now and Steve Laws. How well is Patriotic Alternative doing? That's your party, isn't it?
Well, it's not a party. We are a community building organization. We believe in three things: community, advocacy, and activism. Now, we attempted to be registered as a political party. The Electoral Commission blocked us numerous times for ridiculous reasons. And we eventually, when Nigel Farage came back into politics, well, when Nigel Farage came back into politics, we were still trying to become registered as a political party, and we weren't allowed to. So we had an agreement with the English Democrats. We gave them our people who wanted to stand as candidates. We gave them our activists in order to leaflet for them. And we worked with Steve Laws and the English Democrats to field a number of candidates at the general election. Almost as soon as we announced that, Nigel Farage came back into politics. This was 2024 at the general election. And at that point, it was over before it even started. Nigel Farage is one of those people who is a political juggernaut, and his involvement in British politics carries so much weight that the previous Reform Party conference, when it was being run by Richard Tice, had around 300 people present. When Nigel Farage got back involved, you know, they were filling the Birmingham NEC, you know, one of the conference centres of the Birmingham NEC. Nigel Farage is such an influential and successful man that if you are going to take on populist right-wing politics when he is active, you are going to be carving out a tiny, an almost, you know, how can I call it? Embarrassing, really, an embarrassing number of votes. You have this niche because he's going to take everything else. So at that point, we stopped applying to the Electoral Commission. We said, let them get on with politics, let them get on with this battle for Westminster, and we will do what we do best. And what we do best is community building, advocacy, and activism. And what I mean by those three things is community building is we hold meetings, we hold social events, we hold camps, fitness events, and we build an ethno-nationalist community. We carry out advocacy. Advocacy is where we fight for the rights of our people. We raise money for political prisoners. We write to the prison service and advocate for the rights of political prisoners. And we take up cases on behalf of people who are of our ethnic group who need our help. So we advocate for the good of our people, for the rights of our people. And the final part is activism. We also go out on the streets. We're part of the protest movement. We were recently at the large protest in Warwick, and we are going to be holding another one of those protests in Nuneaton at the end of this month on the 28th of March. So if any of your viewers would like to attend that, we would absolutely welcome them. I am doing that in conjunction with Steve Laws. There was also the National Front there. There was also White Vanguard. There was also the British Democrats. Other groups who want to attend are welcome to attend as long as they stick to our code of conduct and agree to behave in a reasonable fashion. Numerous speakers spoke there, myself, Laura Towler, Hugh Anthony, Steve Laws, and we are going to build a powerful ethno-nationalist protest movement. So by doing those three things, community advocacy and activism, we are building something very different to a political party. Now, that means that when Restore Britain was formed, not that it has been formally registered yet, it wasn't something I was particularly concerned about. Now, I can imagine a lot of people running micro parties were very, very upset and probably very, very depressed at the thought of Rupert Lowe starting a political party. Because if you were running a micro party the day before Rupert Lowe started his political party, you probably thought you were going to hoover up everything to the right of reform. However, when Rupert Lowe started his party, he gobbled up everything there. And now, if you are running one of these micro political parties that's got 100, 200, 250 members, you're not going to eclipse Rupert Lowe. In fact, you're going to be completely eclipsed by Restore. So the political ground now on what you could say, the populist right has been completely gobbled up by Nigel Farage and Rupert Lowe. We, on the other hand, are going to keep doing the things we do. There is no other group in Britain that takes the approach we take. We are very open to working with other groups, the Woodlander Initiative, Remigration Now. We work with people like David Clowes from Unity News Network, and we build and are happy to build a coalition of groups that want to work together for the good of our people. So we're very open to unity. We're not trying to, carve out some little niche for ourselves and get involved in these sort of bun fights that you see a lot of these micro parties involved in. And by basically being unshackled from the electoral process, it allows us to do the things that are important. And it also means that if we feel passionately about something, we can pursue that without having to say, well, look, general public, we need you to vote for us. So we have to sell this thing that you probably won't understand or agree with or believe in to you. We're not really bothered if the wider public doesn't support some of the things we do. If the wider public doesn't support our prisoner support program, well, so be it. We don't have to sell it to them because we're not going down the electoral route. And a lot of these micro parties are constantly trying to sell things to the British public that they don't understand or can't get their head around properly. And then they get, 1.2% of the vote, and it's all been a big waste of everyone's time and money. And we simply don't want to go down that route.
No, fair enough. So, there's a big sort of ethnic push from your side of things. I get that vibe. We've had a chat about it for nearly half an hour. I understand that. So, what about people that aren't ethnic nationals, who say yours, Rupert Lowe, Steve Laws' ideas contribute to hostility or division of the British society at large?
Well, that's a really, well, how can I say this politely? That's a stupid point to make. And it's a stupid point to make because the British people were not divided until mass immigration took place. The greatest division between the British people when we were an island nation made up of England, Scotland, and Wales was when we played rugby against each other or football against each other. As a young man growing up in Britain, when England played Scotland, it was a big event. When Paul Gascoigne, ran down the middle of the pitch and scored that absolute screamer of a goal, the English cheered and laughed and the Scots cried. And that was the division in Britain. The divisions in Britain now are much greater, and they haven't been created by white Britons or by ethno-nationalists. They've been created by politicians who have brought other ethnic groups here that are so different to us, there is no hope of these people fitting in. They have created a multi-ethnic sectarian society, and that has been created by design. That is not the fault of people like me who speak the truth. It is not the fault of Indigenous Britons who, by and large, have always been against that level of mass immigration and that sort of immigration. And there are different types of immigration, but mass immigration from the developing and third world has been something that the vast majority of white Britons have always opposed in one form or another. The fault for all of this lies at the feet of the politicians who have done this without our consent, against our wishes, and have created this sort of ethnic or racial tinderbox, which is now causing so many problems. And when I say that, I'm not just talking about white or non-white. There are multiple different ethnic lines which create divisions. Hindus don't like Muslims. Shiites don't like Sunnis. There are different black gangs that murder each other on a daily basis because they come from different postcodes or have slightly different, ethnicities and, ethnic loyalties. We don't want any of that here. Britain should not be a battleground for all these different ethnic groups. It should be our homeland. It is our homeland, and it should be a place where we feel safe to go about our daily business and raise our children.
You know what? That's a very interesting point because when I was born in 86, so when I was a younger chap, whites weren't whites, and I say that as a broad term, white Europeans, English, whichever term you want to use, were the majority. And it seems like things have got progressively worse now. People would say it's migration. People say it's the small boats. You could point a finger in many different ways, but what I want to get to is a different point entirely. Going back to my earlier point, doing my research on you before I reached out, obviously they call you all these names and they tarred you with all these different things. So what's your view on Israel? Now, the reason I ask up that is because they charge you with being a Nazi. Obviously, you can see where I'm going with this conversation, but Israel, from what I can gather from my research, is, and through people I've spoke to out there, is an ethno-religious state where everyone, I assume, everyone is Israeli, Jewish. Obviously, you've got different sects of Judaism in there, but for the most part, Israel is supposed to be like a safe zone, a safe country for Jews, regardless of what type of Jew you are. It seems funny how Tommy is saying that the Israelis should have a state of their own, that's an ethno state, an ethno religious state, but not the UK. And that we're like almost like a Brazilian style melting pot. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but be honest. So what's your view on the Israel side of things? Because it seems like everyone's all okay with that, but when it's the UK wanting an ethno state, then it's wrong.
Well, look, this is the greatest hypocrisy of our time. Powerful Jews who live in Britain and have wield vastly disproportionate power. They're a tiny percentage of the UK population, but they wield vastly disproportionate power in terms of the number of seats in Parliament, in terms of their influence over Parliament, and the way that they distort both our domestic and foreign policy. These Jews wield huge amount of power. But not only do they wield huge amounts of power, but they do so in a way which is fundamentally not only to our detriment, but also hypocritical. So people who support Israel, especially powerful Jews like the British Board of Deputies and the little lapdogs, like little Zionist lapdogs like Tommy Robinson, they will tell you all day and all night that Israel deserves to be an ethno state, that Israel is a place for the Jews, that the Jews have a right to a homeland, that they have a right to a homeland which they can defend, where they can control their own borders, that they shouldn't be taking refugees, that they should be able to do what they want to their neighbours. Some people that Tommy Robinson has just met, the disgusting fat blob in America called Randy Fine, he will tell you that in fact, Israel has the right to starve the Gazan children. Disgusting. But these same people will tell you that actually white Britons do not have the right to be a super majority, that we don't have the right to our own ethno state, that the English do not have a right to our homeland, that we should share our homeland with everyone else. So the British Board of Deputies will say, yes, Israel has a right to defend itself. The British government should defend Israel. We should send money there. We should sell them weapons. We should allow them to do what they want in defense of their ethno-state. But then when somebody says, well, look, there's tens of thousands of illegal migrants coming into Britain every year, raping white girls, you know, attacking young men, claiming huge amounts of benefits, living in hotels, huge amounts of taxpayers' money. I think it's about £8 million a day is spent housing these people in hotels. The British Board of Deputies will turn around and say, don't be so racist. Refugees welcome. Why? Why? Why is it that these people who support Israel, who support an ethno-state for Jews and wield this huge amount of power, are all completely behind a place for Jews, but don't think the English have the same right? That's a massive hypocrisy. And Tommy Robinson is a scumbag. Tommy Robinson is a guy who will fly around the world campaigning for the rights of Jews. But if you ask him, should the English remain a majority in England, he will reel off 101 reasons why black people should come here, Indians should come here. He was outside the Iranian embassy the other day making clips about how he would allow more Iranians to come here because they're good people, they don't create problems. Why? Why do we have to be the nation that opens its borders, welcomes everyone in, hands everything to them on a plate, and then watches our own people become a minority and a hated minority at that, whilst Jews get to do the very opposite? And why are the people that advocate for open borders here the same people that advocate for closed borders and an ethno-state in the Middle East? This hypocrisy needs to be called out. And this is why I'm banned on X. It's why I can't get a bank account. It's why I can't travel to places like America. And it's why Tommy is making millions of pounds a year. It's why he travels everywhere. It's why he's got the freedom to do whatever he wants. It's why he's spending £455 on a T-shirt and £5,000 on a pair of shoes. It's why his son is traveling around as an influencer on private jets. It's because if you bow to these powerful Jews and you advocate for Israel, you will be paid for doing so. You will be given freedom. You will be given the right to do as you please. Whereas if you say, hey, there's some hypocrisies going on here, you will lose everything like I have.
So you called out what you saw as a double standard. And
massive double standard, yes.
And they smeared you as a Nazi and you've been debanked. And what
yep.
countries are you not allowed to go to? You said there was more than
29
one.
European countries plus a complete ban from North America.
Just for calling out, calling it how you see it.
For speaking about two things, speaking about demography and who controls Britain. Those two things. I speak primarily about demography and I talk about the disproportionate power that Zionists wield in the West. Those are the two things I talk about. And if you look at what's going on in the world or what has gone on in the world over the last few years, I can tell you this unequivocally, there is no other nation on the planet who would be allowed to indiscriminately slaughter women and children in multiple different countries, kill foreign leaders, starve refugees, and attempt to drive millions of people out of their homes without international condemnation, sanctions, and even military action being taken against them. But Israel can do all of those things, and all we do is send them more money.
Right, okay. I didn't know any of that. So that's all a learning point.
Well,
for
no,
me.
You must know that. I mean, look, come on. You're an educated guy. You must know what's been going on in Gaza. You look, I don't want Palestinians here in Britain. I want Britain to be for us. But also, I don't want to see Palestinian children being slaughtered. I don't want to see aid workers being strafed by Israeli jets, which has happened. You know, how many foreign nations or how many nations on the planet would get away with killing aid workers, delivering medical aid, food and water to women and children, and it just be brushed under the carpet? You can Google all these things. Israel is essentially a country that has subverted Western domestic and foreign policy to the point that they have the complete ability to do as they please, even to commit genocide, which the UN has determined that they have done. The UN has determined they have committed genocide in Gaza, yet America, Britain, and numerous other countries are still dancing to their tune, and nothing will happen about it.
Okay, so that all to one side. I'll just put a pin in that for a moment. Do you think 2 points to this question? Do you think that the Jews should have a homeland, a Jewish state of their own? And second point is, a lot of people that have come out as ethno-nationalists and Catholics and Christians recently have said that they are Zionists, that they believe that Israel should have a right to exist. Regardless who lives there, I think it would still exist personally, but like as it is. So do you think this is people just toeing the line and Israel is should be there or shouldn't be there in
I'll say
its
this.
current
I will
form?
say this, and I'll start this with an interesting point. I have said today, at the beginning of this, you asked me sort of about remigration. I laid out what I believe to be a very sensible, humane, and lawful way about ensuring Britain remained ethnically homogenous and a stable ethno state. None of that was illegal. None of that was a call for violence. Yet for saying those things, you can be deplatformed, you can have prevent at your door, you can have the police looking at your social media accounts and potentially arresting you, you can be debanked, you can have a travel ban put upon you, okay? For just saying what I said earlier, which I think were pretty reasonable points. Now, you have Israel killing children, starving refugees, assassinating foreign leaders, destabilizing sovereign nations, arming terrorist groups like Al-Nusra Front in Syria, which are just the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. You know, if you believe that Al-Qaeda were the ones that blew up the Twin Towers on 9/11, why is Israel funding them and arming them and giving them air cover? Because that's what they've been doing. Now, I believe that all people all over the world deserve an ethno state. Okay, they deserve their own place in the world. And I'm not saying that Jews do not deserve a place in the world, but what I'm saying is, why do powerful Jews use their power in the West to silence people like me for saying something reasonable, like I said earlier, yet they support a state in the Middle East which is committing genocide and war crimes? Now, this is the thing, isn't it? And what I'm putting to you today is not that Jews don't deserve a place to live. What I'm putting to you today is that Jews are creating an ethno state for themselves whilst denying that right to people of European descent, people like us, you know, the English, the Scottish, the Welsh. And isn't it funny that every single time Israel strikes a foreign nation. Israel was heavily involved in the war in Iraq, not on the ground, but in the preparations. And this all came out in the Chilcot inquiry. Tony Blair said that he did meet, you know, leading Israelis who helped America and Britain, not with information about, you know, important military sites in Iraq, but with making the decision to attack Iraq illegally. Now Israel has destabilized Lebanon, Gaza, Syria, and now Iran. They do all this, but where does the flood of refugees and displaced people go when Israel commits these actions or prompts the West to commit those actions? They all come here. So wars for Israel in the Middle East, which help Israel grow, ensures Israel's power and position in the region, only create floods of human traffic that come into the West, and we pay for it twice. We often pay for Israel's military excursions. We often carry out their dirty work, and then there is always blowback, and the blowback is huge amounts of people leaving the Middle East, and we face the blowback. How's that a thing? How's that fair? How does this keep happening? Well, it keeps happening because powerful Jews in Britain silence people like me who speak the truth about this, and they pay people like Tommy Robinson, pay them handsomely, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of pounds a year, They build up their social media accounts, they fly them all over the world so that it appears that the populist right in Britain, who should be enraged about what's going on right now in the Middle East and should be saying, whoa, whoa, we need to back away from this. We shouldn't be supporting Israel. We don't want hundreds of thousands of Iranians coming to Europe. But instead, Tommy Robinson stood outside the Iranian embassy saying, oh, no, we should let them in. This is great. We've got to support Israel. This is all part of the greater Israel plot or scheme or plan to create a powerful state for Jews in the Middle East. But at the same time, what does it do? It reduces every other sovereign nation to either, flames and destruction in the Middle East or here in the West. It reduces them to multicultural states. And once we become multicultural states, once we lack in-group preference, once we are riven with division, our nations, our countries collapse, and it leaves one country in the world towering above everyone else, and that one country is Israel. I don't want to be ruled by Israel. I don't want to be ruled by Zionists. I want England to be ruled by Englishmen for Englishmen, and I don't want to see Western nations be little more than military puppets for a Zionist regime that cares nothing about white people.
That almost sounds like what was it? The melting pot, Kalergi plan, Kalergi.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And for those that don't know, they should go have a look at it. Something about every nation becoming well, no ethno states anymore, essentially, wasn't it?
But yeah, but there is one. That's the point. So powerful Jews in the West campaign for multiculturalism in every Western nation. They pass laws that discriminate against and silence ethno-nationalists. They support mass immigration. They support all kinds of policy reform and social changes that reduce white birth rates, but they do the very opposite in Israel. So there is only going to be one group of people in the world who have a homogeneous, powerful, ethnocentric state. And it's not going to be us.
So why do you think they're pushing this?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious from what I'm saying. They covet power and they want to be they understand that power comes through ethnocentrism, that power comes from understanding in-group preference and understanding that if you have in-group preference and you stand together as a group, when everyone else is either divided, atomized, or pursuing individualism, your group will be the most powerful. So let's say you have a room full of 100 people. 100 people. Now, if there's a group of 20 amongst that 100 who work together and look after each other and act as a group and always have each other's backs no matter what, numerically, they are still a minority. They only make up 20% of those in the room. But if the 80% are all bitterly divided and act only as individuals, the 20% can dominate the others. Now imagine that on a global scale. Every nation is at war with itself, riven with division. Every nation is, or all white people pursue this individualism. Then ethnic groups come to Western nations and it all gets divided. They all become multi-ethnic sectarian societies where people compete for resources, they compete for money, they compete for a better slice of the pie for their particular group. So they're all divided. But in the Middle East, there is this one nation that acts for itself, that acts for the good of its people to make sure that it is the preeminent state in the region. They have this huge amount of power by sticking together. And we just don't have that. And largely, we don't have that because policies that the Jewish diaspora, both social and legal policies that the Jewish diaspora has pushed for in the West, has left us atomized and isolated. Our family units have been broken down. People pursue materialism. Rather than wanting to have children, we are all looking after ourselves. We're all looking after short term, our desire for short term pleasure.
Okay. Now
I
I
mean,
can't.
look at who was just if and if anyone doubts me, right? I think we'd all agree, everyone watching this is probably going to agree that the feminist agenda has been damaging to the family unit in the West. The idea that women should, rather than embrace a man, they should compete with a man and attempt to do sort of male-centric tasks to prove that women can do everything. And in doing that, they certainly shouldn't marry a man or settle down or have children with a man, because that would undermine their individualism, their strength, and their ability to show men that they can do it all on their own. Well, who's pushed feminism? Just go on Wikipedia and type in list of Jewish feminists. It's pages long. Pages. Who brought about feminism? Who's pushing pornography? Who owns OnlyFans? Look who owns it. Who owns Pornhub? It's a rabbi. It's a rabbi.
Is it really? I didn't know that.
Who is pushing all of these things upon our people? Who owns the media? There are charts out there that list all the people who writes the books about white privilege. Who are the professors in university that are teaching young white people to hate themselves and to rebel against their ancestors and despise their history? Now, I'm not saying it's all Jews, and I'm not saying it's only Jews that do this, but Jews are vastly overrepresented in the kind of activities that I'm talking about, and are often people who play roles in these activities that could be described as instigators. They are people that play central roles in getting movements started that are ultimately detrimental to our long-term survival.
Okay, that's a lot of food for thought, to be honest. But I just want to bring it back to the point about Western nations being divided. I've seen more and more of it as I've got older, and I'm 40 this year. And it was never this bad. I mean, yeah, you'd have like the occasional. We all knew some twat who was a bit of a racist or someone who'd make a gay. There was always someone who had a gay joke or whatever. And I remember, I think we peaked in the 90s where. Nobody give a fuck. Okay, you're gay. Oh, I don't agree. You don't agree. Whatever, people don't agree. But okay, that's your business. Oh, you watch porn. That's your business. Oh, you're black. You're Muslim. It's your business. All of a sudden, I've seen over the past, call it 15 years, there's this massive sort of merge of everything being a problem now. Where do you think that has come from?
Well, it's come fundamentally from hate crime laws. It's come from a huge shift to essentially censor speech. I mean, what's wrong with making jokes about gay people? What's wrong with making jokes about anyone? Because you sure as hell can make jokes about white people. You can make jokes about straight white people, white families. You can make jokes about Christians, so why can't you make jokes about Muslims? If you can make jokes about straight people, why not about gay people? If you can make jokes about white people, why not about black people? The fact is, the policing of our speech has been something that has accelerated drastically, both in terms of legislation through the government and in terms of the way the media have weaponized the idea that if you say something that's unpopular, you should be hounded, you should be banned off social media, you should lose your job, and you should face social repercussions, which are so strong that it leaves people sat in their houses feeling as if they can't speak their mind and bottling everything up. Now, look, if you happen to be gay, which I don't think you are, but if
No,
you have a
I'm married to a woman, to a woman.
so, but if you're gay and you want to do that in your bedroom, it's up to you, right? But why do we have to have grown men walking down the street in bondage gear performing sex acts on each other on a Saturday? In broad daylight, in the middle of August, in front of families going out shopping. Why
Oh,
is it
actually.
gone?
It was the podcaster Andrew Gold. I met him last year at the Battle of Ideas in London. He actually said, I'm sure it was him, he was at a Pride march just go to see what it's like. And he saw two men doing that in the middle of the day.
Yeah, but why do we have to see that? Well, you see, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Why has it become normalized? Why have the people in power made it normal for two gay men to perform sex acts on each other in broad daylight at a festival and then termed it pride? Well, again, it's an attack on the family unit, it's an attack on decency, it's an attack on morality, and it's an attack on children. And ultimately, that last point is more prescient than ever, because you can see what they're doing to our children. It's constant sexualization, abuse, trying to get children to accept things which are absolutely sick and twisted. And a lot of this then is all wrapped up in careful marketing. The word pride, rainbows, love is love. Well, is any of this good for us? Does any of this make life better for regular folk? Is any of this actually helping children? Because they would talk about safeguarding, don't they? Safeguarding children, whilst, a drag queen is reading to them, and the drag queen's associated with another drag queen who's committed sex offences against children and then goes on to die after having sex with a dog. Those are the sort of people that these people say love is love want your children to be exposed to. And women are take this because, one of the core British values we're told is tolerance. Well, I say that tolerance is not a virtue, it's a sickness. It's a
Yes.
sickness that has been pushed upon us, and many Western people now are afflicted with that sickness, and we need to purge that sickness, and we need to be less tolerant. Because remember, tolerance isn't a good thing. You tolerate something that you don't fundamentally like. You take a walk to the shops, and you tolerate the stone in your shoe because you're thinking, well, it's going to be a short journey and it's raining, so I don't really want to stop and take my shoe off and get the stone out. But the stone's hurting your foot. You tolerate things that you don't like or that harm you, and you tolerate them to your detriment until you can tolerate them no further. Why is it a virtue to tolerate things that harm you and your family? It's a virtue because the people in power have twisted everything and turned it against us. Even our core values that now apparently underpin our society are actually evils that do anything but underpin our society. They destroy traditional British society. They destroy any last ethnocentric pockets around the country in order to leave white Britons as isolated, atomized individuals who are then prey to ethnocentric groups brought here from overseas, who are handed everything on a plate and often learn to hate us when they arrive here. Because as soon as they get off the boat, the first thing they're probably given is a nice hotel room and some money. But if, they start doing some watching of the television or some reading of the books, they'll soon learn about how the white man is evil, how British people oppressed everyone, how we're basically demons in human skin that, have this great privilege and have been keeping them down for not just decades, but for centuries, maybe even millennia. What is this? Well, it's a system of not just replacing us, but it's a system of turning us into a hated minority who are preyed upon by those brought here to replace us.
And that's a very sort of deep point as well. I know we're sort of getting pressed for time. We've got about 15 minutes left. I know your
Look, and this
calendar
is why
is.
people like Andrew Gold won't debate me. There's people like Andrew Gold and Liam Tufts and Tommy Robinson, fundamentally cowardly people. They would never debate somebody like me because I can actually answer what they are saying. I can actually put these points over in a relatively articulate and engaging way. And it's why I'm so heavily banned. I'm not banned because I'm making ridiculous points. If I was making ridiculous points and I was some kind of racist caricature, I would be on X and I'd be boosted to the moon, because then everyone would laugh at me and say, look, this guy is ethno-nationalism. That's why we don't want to be ethno-nationalists. So they get rid of people like me. And then you have people on X who do things in such a clownish way. They're getting millions of views, but they look like complete idiots and they embarrass our cause. They'll turn up and do street stalls with two or three people, dressed in what looks like a Hitler cosplay outfit. They're allowed on X, and they will get millions of views for doing that because people are laughing at them. No one's going to let me go on X and get millions of views because what I'm saying is relatable. And when people do upload clips of me on X, like Jake Shields recently did, they go viral. You know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people see them and go, why isn't this guy on X? I agree with everything he said. How have I not heard of him? We've not heard of me because I'm basically the most banned man in Europe because what I say makes sense. And anyone that fact checks it, like the points I've made about, you know, IDF planes killing civilians and killing aid workers, they'll find out it's all true. And then they'll be like, well, why didn't I know about this? We didn't know about it because there is an aggressive agenda in place to keep the truth from you.
Okay. So what does the future look like? If we could fix things, what would the future look like? If, say, I'm a Harry Potter wizard it and you're Prime Minister tomorrow, Mark, what are you going to do to fix the country?
Well, like I said, the first thing you do is you'd stop immigration. You would then start a system of repatriation or remigration, as I said, and I laid it out earlier. You would put in place lessons in schools which taught white Britons to be proud of the great things that their ancestors did. Why is it wrong to have national pride? Why is it right to teach white kids that their ancestors were evil slave owners when, in fact, Britain was the one country that, on a global level, opposed slavery and essentially brought it to an end. So, if slavery is the big evil, why aren't our kids taught, well, you're actually the descendants of people who ended slavery? That's what the British Empire did.
It did, yeah. Yeah, it
But
did.
instead, we're told, oh, your ancestors were white people owned slaves. You know, self-flagellate a little more, white man. Hate yourself a little more. You know, these are simple policies that could turn things around. Repeal the ridiculous hate crime laws. Tear down the facial recognition systems. Put an end to digital ID. You know, enshrine things like jury trials. Have free speech for everyone in Britain. Build an ethno state, a high trust, high IQ ethno state for Indigenous Britons where our children are safe to play in the street, where men and women feel safe to voice their opinion when something's going wrong. Build a country where you have a representative democracy that really represents the people. Why is it a taboo to point out that democracy, which is another one of these apparent British values, doesn't work? How many people are there in Parliament that actually represent our views? Two, three out of 650 seats? We just want a better world. And we don't just want it for white Britons. If you said to me, Mark, what about other people? Well, yeah, I want the same for the Japanese. I want the same for the Indians. Let India be an ethno state. Let Afghanistan be ruled by the Afghans. I was against the war in Afghanistan. If Afghans want to live under the rule of the Taliban, as long as they don't threaten their neighbors or us, let them. If the Japanese want to live like proud ethnocentric Japanese men and women that honor their ancestors, let them. Let everyone control their own destiny, live within their own areas. We can trade, we can visit each other. You know, there's no reason why we can't have the Olympic Games or, you know, the World Cup. We can even learn from each other if we wish to. But the fact is, good fences make good neighbors. Every group of people, every ethnic group has their place in the world. But why should it be on the same street here in England? It shouldn't. You know, Japanese people in Japan, Nigerians in Nigeria, why should they all be on the same street in England competing against each other for a slice of the pie?
Mark, that's a brilliant end to this episode. Thank you ever so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much. If people want to hear more from me, check me out on Rumble, check me out on Telegram, check me out on Gab. I mean, all those good places. I produce regular content like this. And if you do give me a sub, I will be very, very grateful. Thank you so much.
I'll put all the links down below in the description.